Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of the World Show, the Free Markets series. This week, a rare treat. We meet, once again, someone who would have been 100 years old this year. He was born in 1912. He passed away, and he's no longer with us physically, but he's certainly with us in influence and in memory and through his great intellectual achievements. He's the Nobel laureate Milton Friedman, the economist who taught at the University of Chicago for over three decades, and who is one of the two or three intellectuals most responsible for disseminating free market ideas throughout the second half of the 20th century and the very beginning of the 21st. Passed away in 2006. I had the privilege of meeting him in 1994, so cast your mind back. That was just at the beginning of the Clinton era. He had plenty to say about the economy and globalization at that time. Here then, once again, he would have been 100 this year, is the author of Capitalism and Freedom. The title of that book says it all. Here is Milton Friedman.
Professor Friedman, in the realm of politics and the realm of power, so much has happened in the past few years that people are ready to believe the unbelievable. I mean, if the Berlin Wall can fall, anything can happen. But in the realm of economics, where things are much more day-to-day and the rules are kind of unforgiving, is such a revolution underway, according to you, or is it just more of the same?
No, there is a revolution underway, in my opinion. It's a dual revolution, too. One is purely technological, and that's the improvements in communication, transportation, and the like. And the reason they're a revolution is because they've made it possible for a company located anywhere to use resources located anywhere, that is people, building, material capital, to produce products anywhere and sell it anywhere and be located anywhere. For the first time, a truly global economy is possible. If I buy something in the United States with a company's name on it, that company may be located in New York, but it may have most of its business in China or in Africa or somewhere else. The product I buy may have some American, may have some items that originated in America, but many of the items may have been come from anywhere. Now, the reason that has been important, and it's been going on now for about 20-odd years or more, is because it makes available to current technological knowledge, to capital, human and physical, located in the advanced countries, it makes available a range of low-cost labor that wasn't before available. That's what happened. That's the way in which Hong Kong, Taiwan, Korea, the tigers of China, of East Asia, have been able to develop. What kept them from doing it before? The fact that you didn't have the communication, transportation possibilities. That's had a very important effect, independently of the political revolution, which I'll turn to in a moment. The effect of that has been that it's made the returns, the wages, the income, of people with high skills in the advanced countries go up relative to the wages of people with low skills in advanced countries, so that the differential between the skilled and unskilled in the advanced countries, in Canada, in the United States, Germany, etc., have been widening for about 20-odd years. On the other hand, it has meant that the income of formerly low-cost, low-paid labor in the developing countries has been going up steadily over that period. So it's had very different consequences in different parts of the world in that respect.
Now, you mentioned different parts of the world, and indeed, people in Canada and the U.S. are starting to get awfully lonely now when they keep hearing about these fabulous growth rates in Asia. And you know, if the textbook says that eventually prosperity should spread itself around the globe, they're thinking, well, when is it going to happen to us? When is it coming to North America? Because we're not doing so well.
No, and that's because we're not letting it. Because we're doing our best to frustrate the forces that are trying to help us.
What could we do?
Open our boundaries. Cut down on tariffs. We don't need I favor NAFTA because it was a little step in the right direction, but it doesn't go nearly far enough. We don't need walls against goods coming from abroad. What we need is rather to let down our barriers, to open them up, and to take advantage of the opportunities for cooperation around the world. But in addition, we need one other thing very, very badly. And we need to do something. I'm now talking mostly about the United States, about our educational system. Because one of our problems of taking advantage of these opportunities is that our educational system is a disaster. We have a considerable fraction of our population is functionally illiterate. And of course, the reason it's a disaster, in my opinion, is because it's a government monopoly. And governments in general aren't very good at producing either goods or services. The way to resolve our educational problem, in my opinion, is to privatize it, to open it up, to let parents choose what schools their children go to make it possible for private, profit-making schools to have a market.
Now, you will certainly agree then, sir, that governments often shoot themselves in the foot even when you accept the goals that they've set for themselves. And so let's assume then that Canada and the U.S. don't go that route. They don't open up. Congress and Parliament try to slow it down. Then what's in store for us?
Congress and Parliament will not be able to achieve what they're trying to do. These forces are so strong, as has been proven in the past, the private enterprise system is enormously effective in finding ways to get around government resistance, government barriers. So I think we will benefit. It will be good for us. But it'll be much slower, much less profitable than it otherwise would be.
And therefore, what's the time frame? Because you seem to be saying no matter what governments do, it'll end up all right in your terms. Then I'm wondering, let's say we do the right quote-unquote things, how long will it take for prosperity to really happen? Let's say we do the wrong things, quote-unquote, what's the time frame?
That's a question that is impossible for anybody to answer. Nobody would have... Just look back and ask yourself. If you ask people... 5 years ago, is the Berlin Wall going to fall? How many people would have said yes? You can't answer those questions because so much depends on what happens politically as well as what happens in the economic world. It'll proceed more rapidly some places than others. At the moment, the place where it's unquestionably proceeding most rapidly is in Asia. It's proceeding most rapidly in China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Malaysia, Burma, you name it, that whole East Asian area.
Now, here's a question, sir, that comes back a lot in papers and in classrooms and in office cafeterias and in brokerage houses, and I'd be curious to have your answer on it. People are starting to make up their mind about the 80s, and on the one hand, you know, they remember the fun and they kind of regret it, and boy, everybody was making money, leverage on Wall Street and all of that. At the same time, they feel guilty. They say, you know, we binged and we overdid it, and these entrepreneurs took us for a ride. So the Reagan years, because that's what it was, the Reagan years, on the one hand, nice memories, but on the other hand, guilt and fear and loathing. And so I wanted to ask you, are we then in, were we on the right track then, and have we lost the knack, or are we now suffering a hangover from too much debt and things like that?
On the contrary, we were on the right track now. We were on the right track then. We're not on the right track now. As a matter of fact, if you look at the figures, the turnabout, it's always said in the United States, they talk about 12 years of Reagan and Bush. That's a bunch of nonsense. It was 8 years of Reagan, and now we're in the Bush-Clinton era because Bush reversed every plank that Reagan favored. And if you look at the statistics, the economy grew very rapidly in the United States, very well in the 1980s. The deficit was going down toward the end of the 80s. And you had a turnaround in 1989 and 90 after Bush came into office. Reagan's principles were, number one, lower marginal tax rates. Number two, deregulate. Number three, hold down government spending. Number four, follow a monetary policy that will bring you low inflation. He succeeded to some extent in all of those areas. Marginal tax rates, the top one, went from, what was it, 75% down to 28%. The government spending continued to go up, but the rate of growth slowed sharply.
But he did run deficits.
He ran deficits, but deficits aren't important. What's important is the level of government spending. And moreover, from 1985 on, the deficit was going down rapidly as a fraction of national income. And then he did tolerate a monetary policy by the Fed, which brought the rate of inflation and interest rates sharply down. When Bush came in, his 1990 tax agreement raised marginal tax rates, increased government spending. In fact, government spending went up more rapidly during Bush's 4 years than during any prior 4 years back to Roosevelt, I think. In third place, Bush, I don't say he was responsible. Congress played a large role in this. But he signed bills introducing enormous regulatory burdens, the Age Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act, and a number of other measures. So in every one of these areas, he completely reversed what Reagan had been doing, and the economy reversed.
Does that mean that we could have avoided the pain we're in now?
Absolutely. If Bush had continued on the policies that Reagan had set, if he had not reversed his policies, I believe you undoubtedly would have had a mild recession. We've been having those for 200 years. But I think today we'd be far better off than we are.
Here in Canada, we are very worried about a crisis abroad where our lenders, our foreign lenders, would suddenly pull on our chain or pull the plug and yank. And we're worried because, of course, this would be an IMF situation like you see in the third world. Is that an irrational fear? Because, of course, there is the dominant view here that now you can keep on borrowing.
I don't know enough about the details of the Canadian situation to answer that authoritatively. My impression is that's at the moment not a major problem. That you can still borrow, but I don't know that you want to. I'm pretty sure it's not desirable for you to do that. But the major effect will be on the exchange rate.
But when you collect a lot of taxes and a third of that goes to servicing a debt, much of it foreign, isn't that a really bad, unbalanced situation?
It's a bad situation and from one point of view. It's not bad from another. I want to ask you a question. Suppose that the interest that you pay on your debt were miraculously to go to zero. What do you think would happen?
I guess you'd pay back the principal pretty quickly.
Would you? Or would government just simply spend more on something else?
Well, I guess I can't answer that then.
Oh, you can answer that.
Or maybe I don't want to answer. I don't want to think about it. You mean they'd just go out and borrow more?
Well, they wouldn't have to borrow more because the money that they had formerly been paying as interest, they could now use for other things. And now I want to ask you one more question. Can you name me any government expenditure that would be substituted for interest that would do less harm than the interest does? The interest payments don't do any harm. Whereas if instead of the interest, the government were to spend more money, they would spend money in ways that would be harmful.
But at the very least, that money goes, I don't know, to some bank in Japan, those interest payments. At the very least, even if the government here kept it and gave it away, people would still buy groceries with it, and it would get spent here.
Well, tell me what the Bank of Japan is going to do with that interest. Is it going to burn up the money?
It's going to lend it back to us.
It's going to lend. Well, then the money will end up back here to be spent for those groceries.
But are you saying, I mean, theoretically, could 90% of our national budget go to the debt and it wouldn't matter? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying something very different. In principle, over the long run, you cannot continuously accumulate debt because sooner or later, that will force you into a hyperinflation. There's no question about that. But it's a question of degree. I know the figures for the United States, so let me talk about that. After World War II, the U.S. federal debt amounted to something over 100% of our national income. And it didn't cause us to self-destruct. We went on from there and brought it down to somewhere around 30% of national income, mostly by inflating it away in the 50s or 60s. And since then, it's gone up to about 50% of national income. That's not good. It's bad from the long-run point of view, but it's not immediately threatening. And at the moment, the deficit in the United States is, I hate to say this, but it's true, is serving a good purpose, because it's the only thing that is keeping Congress from spending too much. You know, we're in a funny situation as a result of after the fall of the Berlin Wall. I keep put it sometime in what I call my welfare syllogism. Proposition one, everybody agrees that capitalism is a success. Proposition two, everybody agrees that socialism is a failure. Proposition three, what conclusion do people draw? That we need more socialism.
I think a lot of people out there are going to believe that, sir, instinctively. You've hit on something, but the reasons are awfully mysterious to me. Isn't it because, for instance, socialism promises a lot more, sounds good, is kind of a feel-good theory. It doesn't deliver, and never did. But capitalism, on the other hand, which does deliver, sounds harsh and sometimes is harsh. Isn't that basically the reason, you know, socialism sounds better and it's easier to promise that?
I don't believe that's it at all. I believe that socialism gives more power to politicians, and that the reason we're tending toward more socialism is because the people have very little to say about what the government does. That the government has become a self-generating monstrosity that sort of decides for itself. Let me ask you some questions. I don't know what the situation is in Canada, but in the United States, we have sugar quotas on the imported sugar, as a result of which, the price of sugar here is about three times the world price. Suppose you had a referendum to all the people in the country, and you asked them this question. You have a choice. You can have sugar that is grown in the United States, or you can have sugar that we import from abroad. The sugar grown in the United States will cost you three times as much as the sugar imported from abroad. Which would you rather do? What do you think the vote would be?
Well, people would vote for cheaper sugar.
Yeah, but why do we have but right now we don't have it. Why don't we have it? Because the people have nothing to say.
Well, then let me seize on that and ask you something that's closer to the Canadian situation. Here, we have supply management for eggs, dairy, poultry, and it's great for the farmers that produce that, not good for consumers, everyone agrees, and in the end, politicians don't know whom to please.
Oh, they do. They're pleasing themselves. Because, no, that's serious. Because the consumers are, interest is diffused. How many people are going to go to Ottawa and lobby against the supply management for eggs, if you have it for eggs?
Mm-hmm, we do.
Yeah, well, maybe that'll cost the average family $10 a year more. Is anybody going to go and lobby in Congress at your
parliament?
Parliament?
No, but the farmers will.
Exactly. And therefore, it is in the self-interest of the legislators to appease the farmers and not to serve the interests of the consumers. That's exactly what I mean when I say that the people have very little to say.
But doesn't that tend to say that even though the Berlin Wall has fallen and communism is retreating all over the world, that socialism will tend to creep back into these modern societies?
There's a tendency for it to do it, unless the people get up on their hind legs and say, we're not going to let it happen. In the United States, as you probably know, there's a very large movement for term limits for legislators. I think that will be a very effective device in changing the incentives of the legislators. The problem is one of incentive. They're not bad people, but you know they're no different than you and me. Everybody looks after himself, number one first. And what we have to do is to make the incentives of the people who are making our laws conform more to the interests of the public at large, to the consumer, and less to the interests of the special concentrated producer groups.
Professor Friedman, to end, I can't resist. I guess this is my favorite question for economists. I've asked your fellow Nobel Prize winner, Paul Samuelson, and a number of others, and I got it from the viewers initially. They all want to know how, for instance, an economist like yourself feels being in a science which, A, is known as the dismal science, and B, where it would seem that nobody can ever agree.
Economics does not have a monopoly in that respect. You talk to physicians about the cures for various diseases, they don't agree either. I don't believe economics is a dismal science. I don't either believe that it's a science in which people don't agree. There is an enormous amount of agreement among economists. However, and this is the problem, everybody believes he's an economist. Everybody knows that economics deals with income and money, and everybody knows about income and money. And over again, I have people coming to me and saying, now I know just how to fix things. Now, of course, I never studied economics, but I've been in business for 40 years. And my answer to him is, look, I've never studied your business. Suppose I came into your office tomorrow and said I figured out how to reform your business. You'd kick me out, wouldn't you?
Milton Friedman. And coming up soon in our Free Markets series, an interview you won't soon forget with a true freedom rider for libertarianism and free market ideas. His name is Tom Palmer. He works at the Atlas Foundation in D.C., but you won't often find him at his Washington office, and that's because he's in the thick of things on Tahrir Square in Cairo during the Arab Spring, or else he's dodging bullets in Afghanistan, or years before that, dodging KGB agents in Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain. That's the kind of life he leads. Here's an excerpt.
It hurts me to think that people suffer under some form of despotism, that they're arrested and tortured for their views or their religious views or just how they want to live. And I had the feeling in the late 1980s that the Soviet Union was going to come to an end, that communism would be over. I think I was a little bit ahead of the curve on that. And it mattered what would replace it. Because it doesn't follow that if one tyranny falls, it's necessarily going to be an improvement. So it was very important that people have access to the ideas of liberty, of constitutional government, of limited government, of freedom of speech, of free market economy, of the rule of law, of toleration. And I moved to Austria and worked with friends there and began bringing books, photocopiers, fax machines, which were very important because the KGB couldn't tap a fax line. They had the ability with those little alligator clips to tap a conversation, but it turns out they didn't have their own fax machines to tap a fax communication. So it was effectively at that time, before the internet, an easy way for people to communicate without being overheard by the security apparatus. And we began to set up networks of classical liberal or libertarian, or just use the old-fashioned word liberal as it was used there, clubs, organizations, getting books published, underground, and even I would bring out Samizdat books just on rice paper to Vienna and then photocopy them and then smuggle back 50 or 100 copies, which increased the number of copies of that book in circulation by 50 times. That's a question of a time frame. I do think that the authoritarian and the totalitarian regimes, they always have this, present this image that they're eternal. It turns out they're not. They tend to be rather brittle. And we've seen this in various regimes. This certainly was the case in Egypt, where there was an authoritarian regime of Mubarak, total state control of the media, including newspapers and magazines, state control of the economy, very strong state with security apparatus, et cetera, et cetera. And it collapsed. The Mubarak regime just collapsed. It turns out it was very, very brittle. This is something we've seen around the world, that these authoritarian states or totalitarian states, they look really tough, really strong. Indeed, they can hurt you very badly if you challenge them. But it turns out they're much more brittle than people think, and they sometimes just collapse to the ground. Look at what happened in the Soviet Union. This monstrous, horrible a totalitarian state that killed millions and millions and millions of people, just ground them up in a gigantic meat grinder, if you will, destroyed people's lives, conquered whole nations, exterminated entire classes and ethnicities of people, and it collapsed in a very short period of time, just collapsed to the ground. What's really important when that happens is to make sure that people have the intellectual resources to understand the importance of good institutions like the judiciary, the rule of law, property rights, a constitution, limited government. So there's at least some chance that something better can replace those regimes.
Tom Palmer coming up soon in our Free Markets series. And this week also in our Free Markets series, once again a reprise of the interview with Milton Friedman, who would have been 100 years old this year. And that's our program for this week. I'm Bob Scully. Thanks.